In this episode of Emerge, I'm speaking with Vinay Gupta. Vinay is the founder of Materium, the creator of the Hexayurt, and part of the team that launched the Ethereum crypto project. Vinay is also a serious spiritual practitioner, having spent over a decade of his life completely dedicated to the path of awakening. This conversation, as you'll hear, is rather brutal. Vinay has a way of blowing up sacred cows and puncturing naive beliefs. It's a rare gift, especially when it comes to the topic of spirituality, and it can't help but be very confrontational. As with last week's conversation with Jem Bendel, the primary topic here is collapse and the real possibility of near-term human extinction. We also go on to myth bust about how this topic of collapse relates to spiritual practice and awakening. This conversation, I found it to be very sobering and at the same time, uniquely enlivening. This is valuable stuff, and I hope you enjoy. One last thing, you'll notice that there's a new logo for the show, and this is part of the beginning stages of the collaboration between this Emerge podcast project and the new Emerge online platform. This collaboration will express itself in various ways over time. And for now, I would invite you, if you enjoy this podcast, to go check out the platform, the Emerge platform. You can find it at whatisemerging.com. And it's already full of great stories and articles and videos with a lot of faces and names that you'll recognize from conversations on the show. So go ahead and check that out if you haven't already. And really excited to be a part of this emerging project. Okay, enjoy the show. The Emerge podcast is proud to be sponsored by the Monastic Academy for the Preservation of Life on Earth. The Monastic Academy, located in Lowell, Vermont, is a training center dedicated to the amplification of human maturity in the age of the Anthropocene. The Academy trains its participants through a unique combination of rigorous contemplative training, project-based learning, and a disciplined commitment to ethical behavior, all held in the context of deep community. The Monastic Academy is currently accepting applications for the apprenticeship program. This program, lasting 2 or 3 months, includes silent retreats, daily meditation instruction, and regular authentic relating practices. This program is free. Other ways to participate include daily visits, week-long retreats, or, if you can work remotely, joining the Academy through the co-working program, allowing you to deepen your practice while keeping your job. For more information, you can go to www.monasticacademy.com. Welcome back to another episode of Emerge. This time on the show, I'm excited to welcome Vinay Gupta. Vinay is somebody who I've followed for, maybe the past 5 or 6 years. I think it's probably the case that most people know of him from his involvement with Ethereum and just being a kind of public intellectual within the blockchain space. But I found out about him before that, when he was tweeting about enlightenment, spiritual practice and enlightenment, and the Hexayurt, which I think I first heard you speak about the Hexayurt, and then you also mentioned that you were enlightened within a Hindu tradition. And I was like, oh, that's really interesting that, you know, you're both developing kind of collapse-related disaster relief materials, and you're deeply practiced within a spiritual tradition. And so, you know, we're not here to talk about blockchain. We're here in particular to talk about the relationship between the what we might call the inevitable near-term collapse of many different social systems and spiritual practice. At least that's where we're going to start. And so, Vinay, I imagine, like I said, that most people know you from Ethereum. So for those who don't know, what is your background with spiritual training?
I was raised agnostic. My father was a Hindu research scientist, largely non-practicing, and my mother was a Scottish sort of default Christian, de facto atheist. So when I got to be about 14, I got very ill. I got chronic fatigue syndrome, and somewhere in there I found Paul Wilson's book, The Calm Technique. And The Calm Technique is a little book, I don't know, it's 100 pages or something. And it describes itself as being a kind of, you know, demysticized guide to meditation. And what it teaches is mantra meditation. And there's a bit of stuff about posture and diet and the kinds of things you might experience. There's no mystical stuff in there at all. And so I picked it up and I did it more than an hour a day for the next 8 years. And large parts of that were sort of 2 or 3 hour a day practice. At the time, I was also in therapy, specifically Rogerian therapy, or what they now call person-centered therapy. That's probably after about 4 or 5 years of meditation, that's kicked in. And that was the backbone of my spiritual practice for the first, really, 8 years. Then in about 94, there was a very, very sudden acceleration. Like, not much happened for the first 8 years. I didn't experience any real changes in consciousness. And then it sort of all caught up with me simultaneously, and my internal dialogue completely stopped. So there was just no voice inside of my head. I moved into this kind of persistently silent condition. I thought I'd gone completely insane, that I'd broken myself. Happened to be reading the Yoga Sutra Patanjali at the time, the BKS Iyengar translation. And at that point, it was like, oh, okay, so what I'm describing and what I'm experiencing are about a third of the way into the states that this book describes. This is clearly for me, right? Whatever these people are doing, that's my stuff. It's my heritage, it's my culture, but it's also the only map of reality I've got access to on which I can find myself. Great, I'm a Hindu. And that eventually led me to meet a guru who had trained under Haidakam Baba, who is one of these kind of controversial wizards of the Kriya Yoga tradition. And I studied under her for a number of years, very, very intensely. I mean, you know, she was the kind of person that would casually put your life at risk if she thought it was good for you, and did. And after a few years of that kind of treatment, I woke up very, very seriously, like, boom, whoa. And then after I woke up, up until that point, I'd been working kind of just enough to pay the bills, but I tried to stay away from money as much as I could. And after that point, you know, literally the week after I got enlightened, I got a decent job. I sat down and I started trying to build some kind of standard Hindu householder life, where I had a little job working for a web design firm, and I had a girlfriend, I had a nice apartment, and it was just like Hindu householder track. Everything seemed fine as you think it would under the circumstances. And then about a year before 9/11, everything began to come to pieces, and I moved on to a completely different trajectory. And that's what led me into all the kind of save the world stuff. But yeah, that's how I got here.
And how did the save the world stuff come into your consciousness or come into your experience?
And there's no way of beating around the bush here. Spring of 2001, I had a vision. And the vision was basically comedic. It was funny. It was clearly intended to be hilarious. And basically what it showed was that the entire human race was going to die, and that it didn't matter very much, but it was going to relieve an enormous quantity of bureaucratic cleanup as the kind of, like, you know, air crash investigation. Like, so we lost the entire planet, huh? Right. Well, we're going to have to relocate everybody, and, you know, we're going to need to figure out what went wrong. And, you know, so there's just a sense of, like, you know, on one hand, you know, it doesn't really matter. It's just the world. And on the other hand, the bureaucracy is going to be so painful afterwards, we don't, want to face it. So there was this experience of being deputized by the bureaucrats that would have to clean up after the end of the world to attempt to prevent it. Not because it didn't, not because it mattered, but because it was kind of inconvenient. And that imprint stuck, right? I mean, my whole attitude to the saving the world thing is like, I've never been able to take it very serious. So it's like, oh my God, all these poor people, they're going to die. It's always seemed to me, it did seem to be in that vision, which is that I'm attempting to, you know, manage the inconvenience of some number of celestial bureaucrats. But in the process, that means doing what I can to save the world dying. But I've been really unable to take it with the full seriousness that you would expect, because the way that it was revealed to me was straight out of like The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. It was like, oh, well, you know, it's super inconvenient. It's really, really, really going to be very, very, very difficult to do all the paperwork. My God, it's going to take a really long time. But on the other hand, if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. You know, like worse things happen at sea. And that's the spirit in which I've proceeded.
Okay. And so if from my perspective, you know, reading you on Twitter and the articles you've created and other interviews with you, like these, this is really what motivates your entire life, is attempting to, I don't know how you would put it, but reduce the worst effects of collapse. Or how do you frame like that kind of part of your life and your mission?
So I'm really only about preventing extinction, right? Mm-hmm. If we manage not to kill ourselves in a hell of a hurry, you know, over the next 5,000 years, we can probably work out the majority of our cultural problems. It'll be a lot easier if we can get into space in a real way, because that will give us a lot of protection from our own stupidity. And it will also give us a bit of room to expand and some breathing space. Past that, I have zero hope for everything else. Right? All of our cultural agendas, all of our notions of fairness and goodness and human well-being and spiritual development, all the rest of that crap, we have blown everything there is to blow on all of those levels. The culture is a shambles. We live in an open-air death camp. We fucked everything that you could possibly fuck, and we'll be lucky if we manage not to go extinct. So my core advice to everybody is abandon all lesser causes. None of it's real. None of it matters. It all goes down the tubes if we go extinct, and going extinct is probably the most likely outcome, not because of global warming, but because of the political changes which will come as a result of radically increased resource scarcity brought about by global warming. Mm-hmm. Right. It's the nuclear weapons and it's the biological weapons that are still the fundamental big killers. But the more chaotic and violent and stupid the world gets, the more that stuff is going to look like a solution. The more you risk a geoengineering accident, or the more you risk somebody, you know, with their designer plague, who's just like, hey, let's fix the problem. We're going to kill all the men who have this particular set of genes because they're the problem, or whatever it happens to be, right? You know, there's just a likelihood that the further you go down into the darkness, the more stupid and crazy the attempted solutions will be, until one of them will turn out to be genocidal. So, yeah, I mean, you know, this is the way that I see the situation. This is not to say that there is no hope of stabilization from things like solar panels and regenerative agriculture and all the rest of that stuff. All that stuff is there, but it shares the landscape with 50 years of biological weapons research since the point where we learned how to efficiently deploy anthrax. Right? You have no idea what's sitting inside a Port and Down or Fort Detrick or the, you know, Russian equivalents or the Israeli equivalents, or, you know, wherever this stuff happens to be. And similarly, officially, nobody's done anything new with nuclear weapons since, you know, whatever, 1980-something, right? Unofficially, you know that the research has continued. You know there are nuclear weapons in space. We haven't got, you know, an either-or world. It's not black or white. It's that we're developing these little green shoots of a better civilization on a landscape where the vast majority of the effort of the world has gone into figuring out how to kill it.
And so I find it's recently when I've mentioned that it seems to me, based on my research, that what you say is true, you know, that there we are kind of hurtling seemingly as quickly as we can towards some kind of collapse situation. Somebody will often say something like, oh, this is just a repackaged eschatology. why is this, you know, for the sake of argument, as kind of a devil's advocate, like, why is this actually different? Like, why is this real versus all of those fantasies of the past?
Well, so, I mean, the first thing is that the collapse occurred for most nations when the English arrived, right? So, you know, the collapse in South America is settlers bring with them a bunch of horrendous plagues. And what happens from those horrendous plagues is, you know, something like 90% population mortality. You know, this is not intentional biological warfare, right? A bunch of people turn up with European sniffles, and in America and South America, that turns out to be like smallpox, right? We had relatively high genetic resistance to our diseases. They didn't. We arrived, they died. Similarly, apparently in the other direction, what we picked up in terms of diseases from South America was syphilis. So this sort of structural problem wipes out the vast majority of the population in North America, and I think probably a lot of them in South America. Mm-hmm. And that was an apocalypse for those peoples, right? You know, the remnants of those peoples. It's the shattered remnants of a civilization that was wiped out first by disease, then by violence, then by hundreds of years of, you know, racism and enslavement and torture and so on. You go to China, right? The population mortality is far less from the Chinese invasions, but an enormous amount of horrific stuff happened in China. You know, the whites, the Japanese, you know, you name it, the Chinese saw it, internal civil wars. India, right? I mean, India has two waves of invasions. First, the Muslims come in and basically act like Nazis for the next 1,000 years. And then the English arrive. And, you know, the population mortality from the English arrival in India is, I don't know, something like 20 million people, right? Uh-huh. It's killing on the same scale as Hitler, but because it's brown people rather than white people, nobody really pays attention. Mm. And, you know, one of the things I occasionally say to Germans is, look, you know, the reason you guys get such a bad rap is because you did your killing at home rather than to brown people a long way away, right? If you think about what the Belgians did in the Congo, it frankly makes the Holocaust look like a storm in a teacup, right? Far more people killed in far more barbarous ways with an equal degree of genetic selectivity. This stuff was unbelievably horrific. But because it happened off camera to people that nobody cared about, rather than happening to German intellectuals with relatives all over the world, it just largely just vanished in history. Hmm. Right? So, you know, it's not that what is happening is something that is unprecedented in this sort of past of the world, right? It's what's happening is that there's a decent chance that white people are going to have a similar collapse in their standard of living to the collapse in the standard of living that happened all across the world as colonialism arrived.
But there does seem to be a difference, though, between that kind of collapse or relative apocalypse and the kind of possibility of extinction that you're talking about.
The extinction thing is a separate bucket, right? So okay. The kind of collapse that we're talking about here in terms of the cultural collapses, the social collapses, even, you know, to some degree, environmental collapses, that stuff is not unprecedented in human history, right? We've seen that before. And, you know, it doesn't seem real to people that it could happen to them until it does. Mm-hmm. You know, if you think of the standard of living drop that you've seen since 2008 in America, you know, life expectancy is going down rather than up. You've got the opioid epidemic. You've got tons of murder. There's enormous amounts of homelessness, vast amounts of college debt, which amounts basically to indentured servitude. You could just pick your master, but you know, you graduate with, what, 3 years of income of debt. All of that sort of stuff is, you know, a civilization which is sliding backwards. Life is getting worse rather than better. And if that continues for another 20 years, think about how bad things would be in the States. Right. So that's your kind of tier one problem, which is the people that had been historically victors in the global, you know, cultural, economic, imperialist game are rapidly becoming losers in it. Mm. And it's not that they're becoming losers because somebody else is coming in and invading. It's a much more complicated set of factors which are resulting in the decline of the West. But there's no doubt at all that the decline of the West is happening.
Right. Right.
Now, problem one. Right. Problem two, you've got the whole global warming routine, right? And the global warming routine, basically, to be honest, not much of that matters, right? Yeah, you know, it's getting a bit hotter, it's getting a bit weirder, the weather's getting a little more violent, da 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 da. Not much of that stuff really matters until agriculture breaks. And mm-hmm. if you get a drought that knocks down food production by 20%, food prices will go through the roof, lots of poor people starve, then they become violent, then the states begin to fail all over the world. Mm-hmm. Right? And, you know, you could easily imagine a famine which would starve a couple of 100 million people to death, and if that happens, the world will never be the same again, because probably 40% of the countries in the world will collapse. Oof. Well, because, you know, what do you think happens if you're in a poor country, right? If you're in, I don't know, Lesotho or Liberia or Zimbabwe, and food quadruples in price, you know, you're going to get really, really apocalyptic conditions very, very, very quickly, because the poor will start to starve and then they'll start to fight. And then the rich will machine gun them in large numbers, and either the poor will win those fights or they'll lose. And none of this is unprecedented, right? We've seen situations like that in other countries year after year after year after year. All those famines in Africa where 1 million people starved or 2 million people starved or 5 million people starved, you know, Ethiopia, all the rest of that stuff. These things happen over and over and over and over again, but because they happen a long, long way away, nobody cares, right? I mean, I care about this stuff. I can't even list off the African famines, right?
Right.
You know, I can't tell you off the top of my fingers. Why? Because 1 million people dying isn't even a statistic to me. I'm concerned about prevention rather than the history. But to give you a sense of how little we care, we don't care enough to know. You'd kind of think that everybody ought to know when 1 million people starve to death. We can't even remember the names of the events.
Yeah. Well, it's overwhelming. There's so much of there's. I mean, if you are opening to the suffering of the world, then it seems endless.
Well, that's because it is endless. I mean, you know, we've got 7 billion people. You know, an awful lot of them are really miserable, and there are a lot of them.
Right. Well, what I guess that means, and I think I have my own answer for this, but it's like, why even pay attention to it if it is endless? And I think there's an intuitive sense that it's endless. So it's like, well, I don't even want to go there.
Well, I mean, the choice is pretty simple. You either pay attention or you become a demon.
Mm.
Right? I mean, if you're the kind of person that can make it through this world without having any real awareness of what's happening to other people, you're a monster. And we live in a society which is a monster factory. It produces monsters as a condition of existence. If you're going to operate a successful empire, the people in that empire have to turn a blind eye to where the money comes from, and they have to be willing to kill to get things done.
Right. Yeah. Yep.
It's a monster factory.
Great. Okay. And I think, you know, I agree with that. I think that people listening to the show probably see the truth in what you say. And it's also a great sort of pivot point to talk about spiritual practice, I think. And so here's the context that we're in, right? You know, collapse is happening in the first world probably quite soon. Extinction is a real possibility. That's the age that we live in. That's the context in which we're alive.
Yeah. I want to really drive something home here, right? It's not that collapse is happening, right? What you call poverty is collapse, right? All those homeless people, that's collapse. All those people dying without health insurance, that's collapse. All those people who are addicted to opioids because their doctors will write them a prescription and their health insurance will provide them a drug that will kill them, that is collapse, right? The thing about collapse is it's not until that it happens to you or your immediate family or your very closest friends that you recognize it as collapse. Up until then, it's just economics.
Hmm.
Right? The collapse is already here. It's just not equally distributed.
Hmm.
Right? And that's not something that came into existence accidentally. There's an enormous list on Wikipedia of the African politicians that were assassinated. Almost anybody in Africa that talked with any kind of sincerity about Pan-Africanism, about the idea of Africa unifying so that it could cut much more reasonable trade deals with the rest of the world, almost anybody that talked about that with any kind of passion or momentum, with any kind of authority, got shot in the head. right? And whether it was the Brits or the CIA or the Russians or somebody else or whoever the hell did it, the bottom line is that the pattern is very clearly there. It's an enormous campaign of political assassination to stop the Africans getting to their feet and negotiating a fair price for their resources, right? So that's not an accident, right? The massive enslavement of the American youth by student loan debt, that's not an accident. This stuff is happening because people are figuring out how to concentrate wealth in the hands of the few, because it's better in this world to be rich than poor for the most part. So the people that want to take care of their families, that want their kids to have health insurance, that want to be able to go on vacation and take their dogs because they've got a nice big car, those people wind up doing a bunch of really unethical things, not because they're bastards, but because they love their children more than they love you. Mm. Right? It's the people attempting to take care of their immediate families and blinding themselves to everybody else's suffering because their zone of concern is their people that creates the vast majority of the machinery, the incentives for the kind of wide scale immiseration that we see. This is the worst of the problem, is this stuff is not being done by hate. It's being done by love.
Hmm.
That's why it's so hard to stop. Yeah, welcome to hell.
Yeah. Yeah, and...
Right? It's brutal. It's absolutely brutal.
It is brutal, and it does, like, it you know, I even think of, like, my own family members, right? Like, I have who are participating in the system that is downstream causing all of the suffering in a more direct way than I am. You know, I've always been extremely ambivalent about getting a job and doing the things that, you know, are prescribed by the American dream, which, as we talked about previously, is kind of dead. But, you know, they're having a family, they're going to their job, and it is out of love. It is out of, like, this is what seems to be on the menu for me to do with my life. And I just, how do we relate to the fact that if it's not hatred at the root of it, if it's love, like, what, how do we respond to that situation of love giving rise to great suffering and, you know, destroying the planet?
Love is not enough, right? It's just not, right? It's by no means the highest virtue.
So what's the step after it? Yeah, what do you need?
What you need to correct this problem is truth.
Mm.
And you can see this in the traditional Hindu chakra model, right? You know, above the heart chakra is the throat chakra, the symbol of love. Above the symbol of love is the symbol of truth.
Mm.
If we tell ourselves the truth about the consequences of our actions, we are no longer able to act in the way that we have acted. And this is the problem that we have, is that all of these people, you know, have a narrow scope of concern. They love the people they love, strangers are strangers. They'll turn a blind eye to stranger suffering because, you know, well, at the end of the day, if I don't do this job, somebody else will. They do the best they can to take care of the people that they have immediate connection with. But the intellectual world model is so shoddy and so inadequate that they can't see the second and third and fourth order effects of the actions that they're taking, both individually and especially collectively. Right? Everybody assumes that, you know, you all go, you vote for who's available to vote, and you've done your part in political participation. But again, it's the monster factory, right? You're not going to be able to vote for anybody in America that's going to dismantle the nuclear weapons stockpile or restructure American society to be zero carbon impact. Right? Those things are just not going to be presented as options. So everybody feels like they do the best they can. But if the sum total of everybody doing the best they can isn't good enough, nobody feels personally responsible. And it's that diffusion of responsibility, the limited zones of concern, and the unwillingness to think holistically about other people's suffering. It's all of those things stacked up on each other that produce this enormous ability to consume the world and consume other people, on the way to having security for our own kids.
Mm-hmm. And for those of us who, or if we are able to see through this full stack, to whatever degree we can, of delusions and problematic world models, like, What is your relationship, and what do you recommend as a relationship to the monsters or the monster factory? Like, how do we relate to that situation?
So at the end of the day, in all probability, we are going to be unable to fix society in the amount of time that we've got. So what we're looking for is nasty, cheap hacks to try and buy us enough time to do something about resource scarcity. Right? If people have enough material possessions in a stable enough economic and to some degree social and cultural niche that they don't feel the need to immediately butcher their neighbors for resources, to some degree we could get people to chill out a little. And you know, doing enough about material scarcity that we could get people to chill out a little is about all that I think is realistic at this point in history, right? And you know, you sort of look at things like basic income, and there are many arguments against basic income. There are many arguments for basic income. But at the end of the day, even a sort of, you know, third-rate implementation of basic income is likely to stop people starving in the streets.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even if you do kind of a crappy job of basic income, it's probably not going to get rid of homelessness, but it is probably going to get rid of hunger. Right? It's probably not going to get rid of people that are uninsured, but it's likely to get rid of old people that wind up living off cat food. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Right. Like, you know, we're not very good at catching people as they slide off the economic cliff. And, you know, even a lousy implementation of basic income is likely to do a pretty good job of stopping that. And, you know, the consequence of that may well be a large-scale reduction in crime, a large-scale reduction in the kind of ghettoization of people that are poor and have always been poor, because the worst part of being poor for many people is instability and precarity.
Yes.
It's the constant stress of not knowing where the money is coming from. If you know where the money is coming from, you could get good at optimizing within that fixed budget.
Yeah.
So I think you might be able to pull an enormous amount of the pain and anxiety out of society with schemes like basic income. Mm-hmm. And if you think about, you know, Scandinavia has, you know, such high quality welfare states. They are, you know, more or less equivalent to basic income in terms of their scope and their comprehensiveness. Surely enough, those societies do seem to be a lot more chilled out.
Right.
Right. I mean, I'm not saying that people are any happier, but they're less aggressively vicious and they're measurably less violent. You know, I mean, I used to live on the south side of Chicago, and, you know, that is a menacing, menacing, menacing place relative to anywhere that I've seen in Scandinavia. Now, there are social factors, there are cultural factors, there are historical factors, there's structural racism, there's 50 other reasons. But I'm willing to bet that the south side of Chicago is a much less scary place if everybody gets $1,000 a month check from the government, you know, summer or winter, rain or shine, regardless of age or living circumstance. You know, if the worst thing that happens to you is that you wind up couch surfing on $1,000 a month and, you know, somehow you scrape by because there's always going to be enough money that day to eat, you've got, you know, you start each day with $35 in your pocket. You know, nobody has an existential crisis that morning with $35 in their pocket unless they've got a health issue.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You may not have a place to sleep, but you will not starve. And you know, this is not a radical doctrine, right? I'm not talking about fixing all the world's problems or producing a massively fairer society. I'm just saying, maybe we could stop shoving people into the abyss with a bulldozer and see whether that makes the rest of us less afraid.
Yeah, right.
You know, and this is a very, very limited doctrine, right? You know, you take, you know, Africa, you know, malaria bed nets, agricultural stabilization, maybe a little work on getting a fair price for your resources. You know, there aren't a huge number of things that you couldn't get done relatively cheaply that wouldn't be very helpful. You know, there's a lot of stuff that could be done fairly affordably if we were willing to focus the effort on the very simple stuff and get that stuff done and get it right. You know, how hard could it be, right? But instead, what we have is this very, very complex, very baroque, very convoluted, you know, sort of general spectrum of concern where we're unable to prioritize. We can't tell the difference between immediate good and long-term good. We don't effectively monitor where the money is spent. You know, there isn't a real sense of right, we're just going to get the basics done and all the rest of this stuff is just going to have to wait. Mm. Instead, we have, you know, equal priority given to, you know, things which are at radically different levels of urgency and radically different levels of criticality. It's all in this bucket marked help, aid, concern, whatever it happens to be. Also, we're not that great at noticing that we're kind of shooting people on one hand and then going around and handing out bandages with the other, which also doesn't help.
Right on. Yeah, that's consistent with what I'm seeing, is that maybe there are many things that we can do that would improve the state of the world, but a universal basic income would be, seems like a kind of like keystone change that would facilitate many other downstream positive impacts. So what I appreciate, Vinay, is that, you know, we started this conversation talking about your own process of awakening. And I think most people who have had an awakening experience and are speaking publicly about it, if you then ask them, like, what should we do in this time of crisis, will say something about a revolution in consciousness. Right. Or something like that. Whereas what I appreciate about you is that you share the most actually practical, but still, you know, quite visionary, but really practical solution to this current state of the world. And maybe we can talk a little bit about, you know, what differentiates your perspective from so many other people who are kind of associated with the milieu of awakened beings on this planet, so to speak.
Well, I'll tell you, I mean, what the crux of this is, right? The main work that I have in the world is the Hexier. And the Hexier is basically the world's cheapest way of making houses. You know, it's a couple of $100 a unit. It's 12 sheets of plywood. You cut six of them in half. You make those into a shallow cone for the roof, and then you lift that on top of the walls, and the walls are just six more sheets of plywood lying on their side, so they're 4 feet high. You can make them out of more insulating materials, you can make them out of fancier materials, but it's just meant to be the cheapest way of turning industrial sheet materials coming out of enormous factories into, you know, something which is much more durable and robust than a tent. I'm working at that level because that's where the problem is, right? We're not in a world that has hundreds of thousands of people who are meditating 6 hours a day because their hunger for enlightenment is greater than any other single driving force. Right?
Right.
And if the people don't want it, they're not going to get there. Right? I mean, this is brutally simple, right? I hear everybody talking about higher fucking consciousness. I'm like, I know how hard it is to get enlightened, right? I did that. And fuck me, it's really fucking difficult, right? I mean, you know, I am a really, really capable human being, right? I really am extraordinarily capable. I went from 14 to 26, and I did not do another thing that mattered in my goddamn life other than work on consciousness, right? Mm. So it took 12 years of, you know, one of the smartest and toughest human beings alive to get that done. Now, I mean, that's not unlike what it says in the literature, right? The Hindu literature is pretty clear. Like, sure, this is really fucking difficult.
Yeah.
If you're going to do this, you're not going to get much else done. It might take 3 decades if you're going to try and maintain some kind of household or existence at the same time. It's going to turn your shit upside down. I got the time and energy to do that because I was incredibly materially lucky, right? And I wasn't materially lucky in that I was born with money. I was materially lucky in that people would let me sleep on their floors. And that's how I got there, right? So, you know, it's not that we've got any ambiguity about what it takes to get people enlightened. What we don't have is a lot of people that are willing to do the work and enough places for the bastards to sleep. Mm-hmm. Right? You know, if the entire kind of climate activism world was doing like 2 hours of meditation a day and kung fu lessons, I would sort of take this prospect of mass awakening a little more seriously, right? But show me the mass effort before we start talking about the mass result, right?
Right. Well, and I will say, like, you know, that rings true in my experience. You know, the Monastic Academy where I'm moving back to, when I lived there previously, it was a real struggle to get anybody to even want to come. You know, like, mm-hmm. We were like, look, you can come here and we will fully support you in your journey to awakening. We will give you good food, you know, place to sleep, great teaching, And like, yeah, not many people were down.
I mean, frankly, if that had existed, you know, in the 1990s, you would not have been able to get rid of me, right? I would have kicked down your motherfucking door. But out of all the people that I ever met, right, I was literally, you know, one of, you know, I was alone on that track. I have probably met 5 or 6 people in my entire life that worked that hard on spiritual stuff, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, okay, there are people that are officially teaching and all the rest of that stuff, but in terms of like my peers, the people that I would meet, you know, in business or in ordinary life or, you know, going to places like Burning Man or whatever, like the number of people that were my peers in my generation that were working that hard in spiritual stuff, it's probably 6 people of all the people that I've ever met. Right. So there is no doubt that having a material support structure really helps, because some of the people that want to get there will die on the way if they don't have a place to sleep. Right. You know, there's no denying that that material support structure is incredibly important. But if we're going to be talking about mass awakening, there has to be mass effort, and there's no mass effort.
Right. And yet, right, we see the widespread practice of things like mindfulness meditation and yoga. And I mean, there's tons of people who either outright or are essentially saying like, look, I have had some kind of enlightenment experience. Often, if you read more closely, you know, they've practiced as a householder for 5, 10, 15 years. Like there is some kind of weird merging together of like capitalism and enlightenment traditions, which I suspect is why we're finding it hard to locate the people who actually want to completely dive in. Because instead of like, you know, where it used to be in Zen, where it was like, okay, you want to do this, then get into the monastery and grind for a decade or more. Mm-hmm. But now it's like, oh, you can read this book and like, you know, you don't need to do that. You can get awakening in this 8-week course and it's chill. Mm. And so I guess I'm curious what your thoughts are around that tension of like, what is it, what is happening as these awakening traditions encounter capitalism and what's going on there?
Nothing. Nothing. I mean, literally nothing, right? You know, people like to talk about the widespread, you know, adoption of yoga as being a great thing. You know, there are 8 limbs of yoga, right? Yama, niyama, asana, pranayama, pratyahara, dharana, dhyana, samadhi. Right? My pronunciation in Sanskrit is terrible. So the first 2 limbs of yoga are all of the very carefully designed moral constraints necessary for the practice of yoga to be reasonably safe. Right? And you're meant to get that stuff sorted out before you start doing asanas. So the first thing is, next to no effort is going into building the moral foundation necessary for yoga to function properly among Western practitioners. Right? I think the vast majority of people doing yoga could not name what the yamas and niyamas are, and certainly have no concrete disciplined practice of those things. Maybe some of the yoga teachers, maybe they know it academically, they're certainly not living the practice. Problem one. Then you get asana, the physical postures, which is what everybody is doing. So my understanding of the tradition is that the physical postures are there to transmute the kind of heavy, inert, dense materiality of the body into energy, or what they call tamas into rajas. Right? So you do all these postures that liberate lots of energy. It produces a kind of fire inside of you. And the fire inside of you, if you continue to generate it past the amount of it that you need for the next phase of practice, turns you into an extremely athletic sex fiend with boundless physical energy and no common sense. Does that sound familiar? Right? They're not doing yoga. Yoga is a multi-stage process of transformation. They've taken one of the engines of transformation and they're using it for animal ends. They are taking the body and they're turning it from something which is dense and heavy into something which is energetic and fiery, because they think it's more fun to be energetic and fiery than it is to be dense and heavy. Well, that might be true, but that's an animal end. It's not yoga. Yoga is the process of transformation. An individual part of that process, it's like calling a wheel a car. They're not doing yoga. They're doing asana practice. Asana practice outside of the practice of yoga does not achieve the ends of yoga. It's not yoga.
Right.
It's asana practice. Now, if you don't do the pranayama, the body becomes more and more and more and more and more filled with animal energy, and people become more and more and more driven by animal-level passions. They become more and more and more successfully animalistic. They get good at wealth, they get good at power, they get good at money, they get good at sex, they are in excellent physical health, they succeed in all the animal goals. Great, fantastic, right? It's probably better that we have people that are happy animals than sad animals, but they're not going anywhere, right? They're just being more successful inside of the cage they were born inside of. How the hell is this going to help anybody other than keeping them out of like geriatric wards when they reach their 70s? So the pranayama thing, right? You know, that's all the funny breathing exercises. What they should be doing is transitioning onto pranayama in a really disciplined way as they get the hatha yoga practice matured. You get to lesson three, you will get good at lesson three, you start work on lesson four, you begin to move your energy to the next step of the path. Like, this is like elementary stuff. I taught teacher training in Chicago for yoga teachers, I don't know, 15 years ago. On pratyahara, the next thing you do after pranayama, right? Mm-hmm. The first of the meditation practices inside of the yoga system. Nobody has any idea what pratyahara even is. There's like practically no writing about it. It gets two lines in the Yoga Sutra mm-hmm. because everybody was meant to know what it was. So it wasn't something that kind of had to be explained. Even yoga teachers have no freaking idea what pratyahara is or how to do anything with it. So, you know, a similar kind of total destruction of knowledge is happening inside of the mindfulness movement.
Yeah.
You know, like, for God's sakes, people, this is not the real thing. And this is the kind of capitalist processing of the cultural material of Asia into something which will allow people to continue on their orbits with a few more trinkets. Right? So, you know, some of those people will go on to have nervous breakdowns. Some of those people will go on to have kundalini experiences. Some of those people will find good teachers and get on the path in some kind of realistic way. But I think it's important that we understand that these things are strip mining of Asian spiritual traditions rather than being authentic practice. I'm not suggesting that people should stop, right? I'm not suggesting that, you know, we put our Asian imperialist hat on and say, no, 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 you must not do yoga. Yoga is, you know, not for you, white boy. No, no, no. If they're doing yoga and they're getting something out of yoga, let them do yoga, right? It's better for them not doing it. Some of them will explode. Some of them will do mindfulness and go crazy. But at the end of the day, you know, for most of them, it's a distinct improvement over what they were going to be doing otherwise, but let's not confuse it with being part of a genuine spiritual trajectory.
Yeah. Well, I remember I first got into meditation in college, and I actually wrote one of my senior essays on Slavoj Žižek's critique of Buddhism. And I at the time, I actually disagreed with it. But now, after practicing in the West for, you know, over a decade, It seems to be hauntingly true. And, you know, he essentially says that Western Buddhism is establishing itself as the kind of hegemonic ideology of global capitalism that allows people to continue to participate in what you call these kind of monstrous behavior patterns without seeing the third effect, you know, the causal effects down the line, while still feeling like all chilled out and peaceful. And yeah. I guess, you know, that seems to be, looking in from the outside, and my increasing concern for the role that particularly like mindfulness meditation is playing in our culture is that it seems to be almost anesthetizing people or a kind of like tranquilizer so that they can be okay in the midst of the insanity of our current civilization design. And so I guess, you know, If we buy that perspective, and I think you and I are more or less in agreement there, like what then is a way to think about an approach and sort of like understand what is on offer with spiritual practice if we're going to, you know, not kind of co-opt them, and if we're actually going to look back at the roots of the tradition and what role do they have in relationship to this time of crisis and collapse and possible extinction? Like, what do they offer us? What is their role properly understood?
So here we have to face some very fundamental truths about the situation that we're in, right? roughly a third of the planet's population are followers of either Christianity or Islam. And both of those traditions have a very apocalyptic vision for humanity's collective spiritual evolution.
Mm.
The fundamental belief system is that, you know, individuals have to do a certain set of things in order to assure their own salvation, but collectively there is a process by which the world will, you know, to a greater or lesser degree be destroyed. And then on the far side of that, you get a kind of spiritual dictatorship in which everything gets sorted out. Now, for people that have been immersed in those kind of ideologies for a really long time, the world being on this trajectory doesn't look wrong.
Hmm.
Right? It doesn't raise a profound alarm bell in the heart of a Christian to see that the world is going to hell in a handbasket, because that's what happens before the apocalypse and the resurrection and all the rest of the stuff that happens then, right? This is just not an alarm condition for about a third of the world's population. This is what it ought to look like if everything is happening according to the divine plan.
Mm.
We have some real cultural problems here.
Hmm.
Right? And against that, you put 1% of those populations who are getting a little bit uncomfortable with what's happening, and then a small fraction of that 1% that are doing some kind of spiritual practice, even if it's just mindfulness stuff and hatha yoga. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Right? It's totally insignificant. It makes a lot of noise in terms of it's something for Cosmopolitan to write articles about. But in terms of the actual machinery of the world that's pushing us down these trajectories, there is zero evidence that any of this crap makes any difference at all. Right?
Hmm.
I mean, you know, this is a doctrine of total nihilism. And it's not that I have no hope, but if we continue to have false hope rather than concentrating our fire on the genuine targets which have some real possibility for effecting change, bugger all is going to happen. And, you know, right or wrong, my role in the ecosystem seems to be to spend a lot of time exterminating false hope and getting people to pay attention to the handful of things we've got left that might actually get something good done.